Thanks, Rabbi Eisenberg. As Rabbi Eisenberg mentioned, part of the reason why we're doing this is, for those of you who don't know who I am, to give you a little bit of a sense of why is Oren Laxer involved with the RCC Mizrahi, and for those of you who know who I am, why is Oren Laxer involved with Mizrahi? And today I thought I'd talk a little bit about miracles, not a unique or new topic for this lecture series. And I think the goal here is to get you to know me a little bit. And I can go through all the facts that I attended B'nai Akiva and Moshe Van, I was head of the B'nai Akiva parent committee. But I kind of thought what might help a little bit better would be to give you all a glimpse into my heart and to my soul. And so I'll apologize in advance if I get a little emotional or overly animated while I'm giving this talk, but hopefully it'll give you a little bit of a taste of things. Now, as Rabbi Eisenberg mentioned, I'm not a rabbi, I'm not a historian, I'm not a philosopher. So any errors or my errors, maybe a little bit Google's errors, but we'll sort of keep that in mind as we move forward. Seems like it's also an appropriate time to talk about miracles, because right now we're entering that period of time in our weekly Torah reading. We're hitting the apex of miracles and miracles in our Tanakh. 10 plagues, splitting of the Yam Suf. So it seems like it's a good time to talk about miracles. The question is that we know that the Tanakh is full of miracles, but today, in modern times, what are our contemporary thinkers thinking about miracles? So if we start back in the 17th century, Baruch Spinoza is very blunt about it. He says that the whole idea that God can perform miracles, that we can change nature, is ridiculous. Can't happen. Nature is nature. There aren't miracles. Miracles in the Bible, fairy tales, bubamises. And certainly there's no miracles that are occurring in this day and age. If we move a little bit more modern, Mordechai Kaplan, who's one of the leading figures, or was one of the leading figures within the Reform movement, primarily here in the United States. So his thoughts on miracles were, well, we need to believe that there's a God who performs miracles for those that deserve it. Because if we believe that, we'll all act in righteous ways to make sure that we can warrant a miracle when we really need it. But they don't really happen. It's a philosophy that we need. Rabbi Louis Jacobs, who was one of the leading figures in the conservative movement in the United Kingdom, he kind of went a little bit further. He kind of said, listen, although today we don't really believe miracles happen, in order to have faith in God, you need to believe that God can perform miracles, even if he chooses not to in this day and age. So what I hope to do over the next little while this evening is to demonstrate to you, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but to demonstrate to you that even someone who just believes that miracles are exclusively a biblical phenomenon, is that today, in this time, we are actually living in biblical times. And if we're living in biblical times, you should have no problem believing in miracles. So we're going to start where we probably should start. We all know this date, May 15th, 1948. Israel is declared a state. The Jews cheer, the Arabs not so much. And five countries attack this small Jewish state with superior numbers, superior weaponry, and the Jewish state manages to hold them off. Now, I can talk about how incredible that is, or how miraculous that is, that this small country of 600,000 Holocaust survivors, farmers, is somehow able to hold off the superior forces of five Arab nations. But I think I want to focus on what was happening in this country at that time. The president of the country, we all know, was Harry Truman. Harry Truman really loved being a senator. That's all he really wanted to do, was to be a senator. He ended up becoming vice president solely because there were two warring factions of the Democratic National Committee, and he was a middle-of-the-ground choice. And so he accepted it. He only became president because President Roosevelt died in office, and Truman became president. Now, at around this time, this was election time, and Truman was not very popular. All the predictions were that he was going to lose the election. In fact, if you believe our illustrious Chicago Tribune, he did lose the election. Dewey wins! So, not a good time for him. The Secretary of State at this time was George Marshall, former General George Marshall. Perhaps the most respected man in politics, and maybe the most respected man in America at that time. And in fact, there were some people in the Democratic Party that wanted Truman to step aside and have Marshall take over and be the candidate for 1948. September 17th, 1947, in front of the United Nations, Secretary of State George Marshall indicates that the United States is not so favorable at endorsing the partition plan of Palestine, i.e., forming the State of Israel. February 19, 1948, at a press conference, he's asked directly, does the United States government support the idea of a partition plan and of a State of Israel? And he answers, well, we're still thinking about it, we're not so sure. Giving everybody the message that the United States government was not so enthusiastic about this idea. So the Jewish lobby that has been pushing for this, they kind of panic a little bit. They go and they speak to Eddie Jacobson, who's a friend and former business partner of President Truman. And he convinces President Truman to meet with Chaim Weizmann, who's one of the leading figures in the drive for the State of Israel. And apparently they have a quiet meeting in the White House where President Truman privately promises that he will support a State of Israel when it happens. But a few days before this is going to happen, there apparently is a meeting in the White House to discuss the whole Israel issue. At that meeting is Secretary of State Marshall, Under Secretary of State Lovett, a junior counsel to the president by the name of Clark Gifford, and a number of other people. And they're sitting there to discuss the whole issue. Now, Clark Gifford, again, a very junior person, he's in favor of the idea, and he's trying to push President Truman to go ahead and endorse it. Secretary of State Marshall, adamantly against it. He says to President Truman, if you do this, you will lose the election. And in fact, if you do this, I won't vote for you. That's how strongly I feel about this. Okay? But we all know what happened. What happened is on May 14th, 1948, at 6:11 p.m. Eastern Time, the United States endorses the State of Israel. A letter signed by the president, this government has been informed that a Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine, and recognition has been requested by the provisional government thereof. The United States of America recognizes the provisional government as a de facto authority of the State of Israel. Now the question is, why did Truman agree to do this? A junior counselor of his suggests that he should do it. And in fact, one of the first acts that then President Chaim Weizmann does when he enters the office of the presidency of Israel is he sends a letter of thanks to Clark Gifford. But the question is why did Truman do this? He's being told by his senior advisors, don't do this. He's being told you're going to lose the election if you do this. What made him decide that this was the right thing to do? The story goes at a 1949 meeting with the first chief rabbi of the State of Israel, Chaim Herzog, the father of the future, Isaac Herzog, the father of the future president, Chaim Herzog, and the grandfather of the current leader of the opposition, meets with President Truman and says to him, I believe that God put you in your mother's womb so that you would be the instrument to bring about Israel's rebirth after 2,000 years. And President Truman is taken aback by this. He is overwhelmed by this whole idea. This is not the first time we've heard this type of statement before. In about 6 weeks from now, we're going to read it. Megillat Esther. Haman has a decree to destroy the Jewish people. Mordechai goes to Esther and says, you need to go talk to him. Why do you need to go talk to him? Who knows if it's not for this express purpose that you got to your leadership role, that you were put in this powerful position. Very similar to what was said to President Truman by Rabbi Herzog. So do we believe in miracles? Let's move on. Six-Day War. We all know the story again. January to April 1967, there were numerous terrorist attacks, army attacks from Egypt, from Jordan, from Gaza. It's not looking good. The people of Israel and Jews around the world are panicked. This is going to be another Holocaust. This is going to be another Shoah. The troops of six Arab countries deploy along the Israel border. After a lot of discussion, Prime Minister at the time, Levi Eshkol, decides we need to do a preemptive attack. Within the first day of that attack, the entire Egyptian Air Force is destroyed. Over the next few days, the Egyptian army, the Syrian army, the Jordanian army, they're all decimated in one of the most one-sided military victories in modern warfare. Unbelievable. This country that is not even 20 years old, once again, outnumbered, facing an enemy with far superior weaponry, and that is able to, in 6 days, to defeat that enemy, to destroy them, to the point in time where on June 7th, that we just celebrated 50 years, just recently, the Israeli paratroopers enter the old city of Jerusalem, and Mota Gur announces over the radios, radio, Har Habayit Biyadeinu, Har Habayit Biyadeinu. The Temple Mount is in our hands, the Temple Mount is in our hands. Incredible. And again, I can talk about the military victory and how incredible that is. But I want to focus on something else. I want to focus on something that's been bothering historians and they don't have an answer for ever since this war happened. And that is the Jordanian question. Why did the Jordanians enter this war? They had nothing to gain. They were already in control of the West Bank. If the Arabs won the war and drove the Jews into the sea, the Egyptians would take the south, the Syrians would take the north, and if they were lucky, they let the Jordanians keep the West Bank. And if Israel wins the war, there's a pretty good chance that the Jordanians are going to get kicked out of the West Bank. So King Hussein of Jordan, why did he enter the war? And in fact, the weeks leading up to the war, Israel kept sending him messages. Stay out of it. If you stay out of it, we'll leave you alone. Stay out of it. Even after the war started, and it was clear, Israel had wiped out the Egyptian Air Force. There was very clear that this war was not going to be won by the Arabs. Israel sent messages to King Hussein saying, if you don't fire on us, we won't fire on you. Hold back. And he didn't. And the historians don't understand why. When you have an enemy that has already kicked your butt, so to speak, why would you go in for more? Again, it's not the first time that this happened. We're going to read about this in a couple of weeks. After suffering from 10 plagues, where clearly it's been demonstrated that the God of the Israelites was far more powerful than anything Egypt had to offer, after sending the Jews out, because I don't want to deal with them anymore, Paro changes his mind, decides, I'm going to go for more. I'm going to go after them. I'm going to try and see if I can do a little bit better. When you haven't so far, what makes you think that now all of a sudden you're going to be able to defeat their God? The Torah tells us exactly what happened here. Vayechazek Hashem lev Paro melech Mitzrayim vayehardoth acharei bnei Israel. And God hardened, stiffened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he gave chase to the Israelites. And I would argue that the exact same thing happened again. Vayechazek Hashem Lev Hussein Melech Yarden. God hardened the hearts, because there was a plan. And that plan we've been celebrating for 50 years now. So do we believe in miracles? Let's move on. Yom Kippur War. October 6, 1973. Happened to be living in Israel at the time of Rehovot. Egypt and Syria launch a coordinated attack on Israeli positions in the Sinai Peninsula and up in the Golan Heights. Israel is underprepared. Israel does not have enough troops to defend those sites, especially up north in the Golan Heights. The Egyptian troops cross the Suez Canal, drive across the Barlev line, and are pushing the Israelis back. The Syrians are coming through the Golan Heights, Har Hermon, pushing the Israeli troops back. By October 7th, a day later, the Syrians are occupying most of the southern part of the Golan Heights. October 8th, Israel tries their best as they're calling up reinforcements to see if they can push back. It fails miserably. And perhaps in one of the most decisive decisions in that war, on October 9th, Major General Ariel Sharon, the future Prime Minister of the State of Israel, decides to go across the canals. They build these boats, these pontoons, to take tanks across so that he can come up behind the Egyptians. He does this against orders. They want his head. Until at the end of the World War, they realize that this may have been one of the things that saved the war, at least on the south. Soviet Union, United States, height of the Cold War, they're fighting back and forth to see who's going to be able to help the other side to be victorious. Soviets providing the Arabs with weaponry, the Americans, under a lot of urging, are providing the Israelis with weaponry. Okay? I'm going to try to make things go a little bit faster. On October 14th, one of the most decisive battles of the war, one of the greatest tank battles in the history of modern warfare, Israel loses 10 tanks to 250, 300 tanks of the Egyptians. 10 to 250 to 300. Amazing. Incredible. That shouldn't happen. Eventually, after numerous tries, there's a ceasefire. And for the first time in 25 years since Israel's been a country, Egyptian and military and Israeli military leaders meet in the Sinai Peninsula to sign the peace treaty, to stop the war. Now I want to focus on something else. I want to focus on something that was happening up north in those first 4 days of the war. The first 4 days of the war, almost the entire Syrian army is descending into, through the Golan Heights into Israel. Up north, they are severely understaffed. The main group that are trying to defend this entire area from the descending hordes of the Syrian army are a tank brigade led by Avigdor Kalani. And what he does over these first few days to try and maintain and hold off this entire Syrian force is he's taking his small group of tanks and he's running them around to this side and to this side and to this side, trying to make the Syrians think that there's a far larger force that they're up against. But 4 days later, he's essentially out of ammunition. His troops are exhausted and he can't go on. And there is an open road. There is nothing stopping the Syrians from descending into the heart of Israel. But something happens that historians don't understand. That with this open road, for some reason, the Syrians stop. They just stop. They stop, they look confused, they don't understand, they stop, and then they turn around and they retreat. And nobody understands why. The war would have been over if the Syrians had gone down through that open door. They would have gone into the heart of Israel. But they stopped. They don't understand why. We understand why. Because this is promised to us in Parsha Mishpatim. It is promised us by Hashem that when we enter the land of Israel, He's going to be there to protect us. He's going to be there with us. And what is He going to do? V'natati et kol oyvecha alecha oref. I will send forth my terror before you. I will throw panic into all your enemies. I'll make all your enemies turn tail before you. Exactly as you promised. That's exactly what happened. Do we believe in miracles? Let's move on to 1976. Again, we all know the story. The raid on Entebbe. Books, movies, different actors in the movies. June 27th, 1976. Air France Flight 139 leaves Tel Aviv, lands in Athens. It takes off from Athens. We know the story. Two Palestinian terrorists, two German terrorists hijack the plane. They take the plane to Libya. They refuel, and then they take the plane to Uganda. And they landed in Uganda the next day. Again, after a lot of consideration, on July 3rd, 1976, the Israeli cabinet under Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin decides that they're going to listen to the plan presented to them by Major Kuti Adam and General Dan Shomron to go and rescue these Jewish people. At 11 p.m., under the leadership of Yoni Netanyahu, the brother of the current Prime Minister of Israel, the Israelis land in Entebbe. They have a car that looks like Idi Amin, the leader of Uganda's car. They have Land Rovers that look like his security detail. They land in the middle of the night. They go to rescue the Jews. One casualty, we all know, Yoni Netanyahu on the part of the Israeli military. Three hostages die as they're trying to save them. One dies later because she was in the hospital when she got killed. But they managed to save them. And on July 4th, 1976, at 12:40 a.m., less than 2 hours after they started this, they managed to free 102 out of 106 hostages. Incredible. And these aren't my words. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, shortly after this happened, he wrote concerning the matter of the Jews who were hijacked in Uganda and were saved by the Israeli soldiers who went to Uganda, it is reasonable that this should be considered an open miracle. Because in the normal course of events, it would not be possible for such a thing to happen. He said it, not me. The audacity of a people to think that in the middle of the night they can go into enemy territory to rescue their brethren? The audacity. Who thinks that they can do that? Avraham Avinu thought he could do that. When Lot and his family in the battle of the five kings and the four kings, and when they got taken hostage, what happened? Vayichalek alehem laila hu v'abadav v'yakem v'yardefem ad chava asher mismol adam esek. At night, in the middle of the night, Abraham and his servants entered enemy territory to save their brethren. Now he knew later on, he knew who to thank for it. When they tried to reward him, he said, no, this is God. Do we believe in miracles? 1981. Iraq is secretly developing a nuclear facility to make nuclear weapons. Israel decides this; they can't stand for this. And after a lot of consternation, Prime Minister Menachem Begin authorizes an attack on this facility, knowing that the world was going to be against them, knowing that it was very risky to again be going into enemy territory. He authorizes it. And the attack is successful, and the nuclear reactor is destroyed. What would happen in 1991 if Iraq had a nuclear reactor? Don't want to think about that. A number of years later, Zev Roz, who was the leader of this mission, the mission including Ilan Ramon, the astronaut who later died in the Columbia disaster, he's being interviewed by a reporter, and after he tells and describes what's happening, the reporter says to him, the way you're describing it, it sounds like it was an outright miracle. Zev Ross says, of course it was a miracle. How is it possible that we can fly over enemy territory, drop bombs on their nuclear reactor, not a single one of their planes, not a single anti-aircraft fire is sent in our way? How is that possible? And then he says, and only in Israel could you hear something like this. He says, I'll tell you something else. There's a lot of discussion about when we should do this. And the command actually wanted them to do the attack at night, so that no one could see them. But Zev Ross understood the importance of this, and he was afraid that if we do it in a night, we might miss. And I don't want to miss. And I'd rather take the chances during the day, before the sun sets, so that I don't miss, even though that's riskier. And he says that's what we ended up doing. And then he says, it was interesting, because when we're flying back, we're flying from the east, where Iraq is, back to Israel to the west. He says, we're flying so fast, we're keeping up with the sun. And the sun's not setting. It's staying in the exact same spot in the sky the whole flight back. And he says, again, only in Israel. We're all radioing back to ourselves. Remember Joshua? Remember Joshua prayed that the sun stand still and the moon stand still? That's what it's like. That's what's happening here. Vayidom ha-shemesh, vayareach, ad yikom, goyavav halohi k'tuval sefer yashar. And the sun stood still, and the moon halted while a nation wreaked havoc on their enemy. Do we believe in miracles? Let's move on to 1991. The first Iraq war. Again, we know the story. Saddam Hussein goes and invades Kuwait. Americans under George Bush Sr. form a coalition and go to kick him out. Saddam Hussein threatens, you attack me, I'm going to attack Israel. The Americans ask Israel, don't respond. We need to keep our coalition together. If you respond, we can't keep our coalition together. Don't respond. And they don't. Now, after the war, this group, I think they're mostly historians and war experts, they kind of looked and saw that during the course of this war, as we know, there were two casualties. And there's some discussion about whether those casualties were actually casualties from the Scud missiles or whether they were people who had heart attacks because of the war. Back and forth conversation. But they kind of looked at it and they thought that seems a little bit low. That over the course of the attack on Israel by Iraq, 38 Scud missiles were shot at Israel. Of those 38, 27 happened, 11 happened before, and then America, just kind of help Israel out since they were agreeing not to fight back, sent the Patriot missiles to help Israel defend itself. 27 after the Patriot missiles, 17 were targeted by the Patriot missile, and in those days the Patriot missile was about 40% successful. So of those 17 that the Patriot missile system saw as a threat, they got 40% of them. That means 9, 10 of them got through. And they looked and they said, of those missiles that got through and landed in civilian areas, 2 deaths. And they said, well, that seems like a little low, but let's do some research and let's see. And so they compared it to 2 other attacks, similar types of attacks. They compared it to the German bombardment of London in World War II. Maybe not exactly fair comparison, we're talking about years beforehand. But then they compared it to the Iraq-Iran war when Iraq sent those same Scud missiles to Tehran. And what they reported was that if you take a look at the deaths and everything else, that in London during World War II, there were approximately 4.8 deaths per missile. Not total, per missile. In Tehran, it was even worse. There were 14 deaths per missile. Again, not total, per missile. And they looked at it and they said, taking into account the Patriot missiles, taking into account population density, taking into account the time and everything else, they said it doesn't matter. What we should have seen in Israel, if it was exactly the same, what we should have seen in Israel was at least 3.3 deaths per missile. Not total, per missile. I.e., there should have been 60 times more deaths than there were. And they looked and analyzed it, and they said it has nothing to do with the Patriot system. They couldn't figure it out. Their conclusion? Israel got lucky. But we know better. The prophet Isaiah, Yeshayahu, he tells us what it's going to be like in the future. Kol kli yotzer alacha lo yitzlach. No weapon formed against you shall succeed. Not just luck. Do we believe in miracles? This is a quick one. I like this one. March 2013, the Jewish population of Israel surpasses the $6 million mark. Important, they mentioned this important on two facts. Number one is now Israel has become the place in the world with the most Jews. More than anywhere else in the world, Israel now has more Jews than everywhere else in the world added up. And number two, they point out, it's an auspicious number, because that's the number of Jews that died in the Shoah. And they're saying that in March 2013, a spark of every single one of those Jews that we lost living and accounted for in the state of Israel. But think about it. I mentioned before, 1948, 65 years earlier, 600,000 Jews. 65 years later, 6 million Jews. A tenfold increase, starting from such a small population, in 65 years. That's huge. That's amazing. How does that happen? Same Yeshayahu, he told us how it's going to happen. He predicted that it was going to happen. Ki yaminu smol tifotzi v'zaracha goyim yirash v'arim nishmaot yoshivu. For you shall spread out to the right and to the left. Your offspring shall dispossess nations, and your people shall possess desolate towns. Exactly as predicted by the Navi Yeshayahu. Do we believe in miracles? Let's move more recently. Operation Protective Edge. June 12th, 2014. Our three boys. We happened to be landing in Israel that day. Eyal Yifrach, Gilad Shar, and Naftali Frankel kidnapped by Hamas. Israel launches major incursions into West Bank towns, desperately looking for our boys. Unfortunately, on June 30th, their bodies are found. You come to mom. Following that, from June 1st to June 7th, 250. Okay, we talked about 38 Scuds in 1991. 250 in a one-week period of time, missiles are fired from Gaza. 7 people injured, no deaths. July 8th, Israel having no choice with the constant bombardment of missiles from Gaza, launches Operation Protective Edge. After numerous failed ceasefires that Hamas kept breaking, finally, after almost 7 weeks of constant bombardment, a ceasefire is signed, and it finally holds. The IDF and the U.S. military took a look at the statistics again. Over the course of that operation, 4,564 missiles are fired at Israel. 3,417 missiles landing in Israel, mostly in open fields. Now, if you kind of look, the Patriot missile, which was 40% effective in 1991, is now 90% effective. Certainly human ingenuity helped a lot. But when you have thousands of missiles coming at you, 90% effective means that 200 to 300 missiles that are targeted by the Iron Dome Patriot missile system are missed. The system identifies them as heading to civilian populations, and they miss them, and they land in civilian populations. And over the course of those 7 to 8 weeks, two people die. One civilian, one soldier. Two. 1991, 38 missiles, two. 2014, thousands of missiles. Hundreds that got through. Two. That's it. That's too many, but that's it. How's that possible? If it was not possible in 1991 that out of 38 missiles, only two people died, it's incredible. It's amazing that with thousands of missiles, hundreds that got through, again, two people died. Luck again? I don't think so. Tehillim tells us, He will cover you with his pinions. You will find refuge under his wings, under the dome. His fidelity is an encircling shield. You should not fear terror by night or the arrow that flies during the day. Elacha lo yigash. 1,000 will fall to your left, 10,000 to your right, but it shall not reach you. Do we believe in miracles? Perhaps Rav Kook said it best. It's Mizrahi. We need to talk about Rav Kook. Rav Kook says, ultimately, both miracles and what you want to call natural events, they're from the hand of God. The difference is that miracles are things we have no control. We don't do anything. We just sit there and it happens. And I can argue some of these were miracles like that. Natural events, those are miracles, but we participate in them. Human ingenuity plays a role in them. But they're both from the hands of God. So do we believe in miracles? We, the Jewish people, who have survived all these millennia, who have outlasted so many other peoples and nations and empires, Phoenicians, Egyptians, Babylonian, Greek, Romans, Ottoman, British, gone. But we still stand here. And today we stand at a time where not a few thousand miles from here is a land, is our land, that has not only survived for 70 years, but has thrived to be a world leader in economics, medicine, science, technology, defense, water conservation, search and rescue, health, medicine. This one little country, a sliver of a land, surrounded on all sides by enemies, not even yet close, but not even yet 70 years old, and it is a world leader in so many different areas. How is that possible? How can that be? Well, it can be because this land is special. Because, and this is one of my favorite psukim in all of Tanakh, in Dvarim it tells us, what about this land? This is a land, Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Doresh Ota Tamid. Enei Hashem Elokecha Ba Mereishit Hashana Ad Acharit Hashana. This is a land which God looks after, which the Lord your God always keeps his eyes on from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. That's why. That's why that this small little land of ours has come such a long way, has thrived so much. So do we believe in miracles? If we treat each other with what Rav Kook called Ahavat Chinam, baseless love. If we remain united as a people, as Am Yisrael, if we continue to follow the tenets and the guidelines that are presented to us in our book, in Torah Yisrael, if we continue to love and unconditionally support the land of Israel, our land of Israel, Eretz Umedinat Yisrael, do we believe in miracles? You bet your lives we do. Thank you.